UPX worker. An audio strike against a monotone world. A podcast of anarchist ideas and action. For everyone who dreams of a life off the clock. Ill winds from Ottawa, thinking through the threats and opportunities as a far-right initiative gains momentum. Published February 14th, 2022 on crimethink.com. Audio version produced by the Ex-Worker Podcast Collective. Opponents of vaccine mandates have established protest encampments in Ottawa and elsewhere around Canada, blockading several routes crossing the United States border. Far-right organizers and former police officers have prominent positions in this movement, and police have taken a relatively hands-off approach thus far. It appears likely that the model currently being tested in Canada will appear elsewhere around the world shortly. In the following extensive report, our correspondent in Montreal explores the sequence of events that led up to these developments, reviews the agendas of the various forces vying for control, and reflects on what we can do in a situation in which the far right has gained the initiative. To preface this report, it's necessary to briefly deal with the question of whether the anti-mandate protests in Ottawa represent a movement for freedom, as the participants insist. On October 25, 2021, officers of the New York City Police Department participated in shutting down the Brooklyn Bridge, where they famously kettled and arrested Occupy protesters almost precisely 10 years earlier, to protest against a vaccine mandate for municipal employees. While we passionately believe that people must be free to make their own medical decisions and determine their own risk tolerance, the police were effectively demanding the right to expose those they arrest to even greater medical risk. This is a particularly clear-cut case showing that the movement against vaccine mandates is not necessarily a movement against state control or in favor of medical autonomy. An authentic movement for freedom and medical autonomy would oppose all the forces that compel workers to expose themselves to COVID-19 against their wishes. In other words, it would be explicitly anti-capitalist. Likewise, such a movement would support striking students intent on determining for themselves which risks they wish to take. When anti-mandate protesters maintain that borders should be tightly controlled by passport checks, yet decry vaccine passports as fascism, when they complain about police checking for vaccine cards, but support police in arresting and imprisoning people by the millions, when they object to the government placing limits on economic activity, but not to the vast economic disparities that force workers to face potentially lethal risks simply in order to pay rent, they are not taking a stand in favor of freedom, so much as they are willfully changing the subject from the encroachments of state power as a whole to a few details of state policy. This is part of the process through which a spurious right-wing opposition functions to redirect rebellious impulses into pseudo-movements that ultimately strengthen state institutions. It's possible that a consistent movement opposing state control in favor of medical autonomy could serve as a space in which those who oppose vaccine passports could go through a process of political development. But for this to be possible, these movements would have to foster a systemic analysis of power, whereas in fact, they are dominated by right-wing elements intent on limiting their political horizons. Therefore, at the minimum, it is necessary to oppose and outflank the right-wing elements in these movements, which is the subject of the following text. Without further ado, the report. Ottawa is just the tip of the iceberg. A number of years ago, in a European city, I made a presentation about anarchist participation in the so-called Maple Spring of 2012, the student strike in Quebec, and the larger social movement it sparked, focusing on the place where I live, Montreal. I emphasized the importance of more than a decade's worth of activism and agitation against police in our city, which was in no small part the result of anarchists' efforts over the course of several years. My argument was that a great deal of the student movement's success in 2012 was the consequence of anarchists' efforts to both explain and demonstrate the virtues of confrontational tactics and uncompromising hostility towards the police. The first question after my talk was about whether people in Montreal speak French or not. "Yes, they do," I answered. The following several questions were all variations on the theme of, "So what's the deal with this Canada thing, anyway?" It took people a few minutes to understand that I hadn't come there to serve as a walking, talking Wikipedia entry. I wanted to compare notes about strategy with them on an international basis. The anarchist tradition has always been internationalist. We want a world without borders, without the divisive nonsense that makes up most flag-waving nationalism. We share an intellectual commitment to understanding the world beyond our own limited geographic and socio-cultural contexts, advocating a globally informed conception of total freedom for everyone. Many of us have lived in other countries. We have friends, family, and connections all around the world. Crossing borders is something we do. All of us have been struck by the importance of words originally written in languages we don't speak ourselves, reflecting on struggles that took place in contexts very different from our own. Today's nationalists want an internationalism of their own. Right now, the globalized far-right movement is looking to the truckers in Canada for inspiration. There have been calls to imitate the events in Ottawa and other capital cities, including Brussels, Washington, D.C., and Canberra. This makes it crucial that people everywhere understand what is happening here in Canada. Over the last few years, right-wing activism and white-majority populism have spread far and wide, thanks to high-velocity memes. One important antecedent to the current movement in Canada was the so-called Yellow Vests movement in 2019, which was inspired by an ideologically refracted view of a decidedly more heterogeneous social uprising in France. The high-water mark of the Canadian Yellow Vests efforts was the United We Roll trucker convoy that arrived in Ottawa on February 19, 2019. It must also be said, without accepting the ludicrous notion that this is all outside agitation, that the current movement owes some of its success to significant infusions of money and support from the right wing in the United States. After the 2022 Freedom Convoy rolled into Ottawa on January 28th, it took more than a week before the first anarchist writing on the subject appeared. It's been difficult to come by credible information, even for me, only 2 hours' drive away. I myself didn't know what was happening until the news media belatedly started reporting that a convoy was headed east. It took a few more days for me to register the significance of what was going on. Economically, culturally, and geopolitically, the Settler Society of Canada is an annex of the larger Settler Society of the United States. For now, the U.S. remains the world's dominant superpower, though things have become polarized there, to say the least. There was talk of civil war in 2020, and the future looks fraught as well. Many have argued that civil war is not the right term for what some people anticipate. The crumbles is an alternative term that's gaining popularity. Whatever we call it, it's certain that the terrain is shifting as crises proliferate and critical systems reach their breaking points. Let's think through what this means for us. To understand this situation, we can start by reviewing the events leading up to it over the past 5 years. November 2016. Donald Trump wins the U.S. presidential election. This has immediate repercussions in Canada, emboldening a variety of groups that oppose mass immigration and Islam, most notably La Meute, the Wolf Pack, in Quebec. On January 29, 2017, 6 people are killed and 5 more injured in a lone wolf attack on a mosque in the suburbs of Quebec City. November 2018. The Yellow Vests movement begins in France, sparked by the popular rejection of a new tax on fuel. The movement is heterogeneous from the beginning, including a large right-wing populist component, but race and immigration are secondary and tertiary concerns beside the cost of living. Beyond the borders of France, however, right-wing activists lead the way in appropriating the iconography of the French movement. This happens in Canada, too. Ironically, the Canadian Yellow Vests are predominantly an Anglophone phenomenon, with over 100,000 members in its Facebook group. By late January 2019, they establish a consistent street presence in the streets of Hamilton, Edmonton, and a few other cities, mostly in the form of weekly rallies, ranging from 30 diehards to a few hundred every now and then. Common concerns include Islam, immigration, the purported tyranny of Justin Trudeau, the security of the border, and the future of the oil and gas industry in Western Canada, with participants calling for new export-focused pipelines from Alberta to any possible coast. February 2019. The United We Roll truck convoy departs from Red Deer, Alberta on February 14th and arrives in Ottawa on February 19th. The protesters depart on the afternoon of the following day. They only numbered a few hundreds, with fewer than 200 semi-flatbed and pickup trucks, according to supporters. Nonetheless, they receive an outsized amount of media coverage compared to significantly more popular demonstrations in Ottawa. October 2019. Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party wins the most seats in the general election, but he loses an outright majority, necessitating an alliance with smaller parties. The provinces of Alberta and Saskatchewan are uniformly represented by conservative parliamentarians. This prompts outrage across the far right and the registration of a new political party, Wexit Canada, later to be renamed the Maverick Party, that aims for an independent state in some or all of Western Canada. March 2020. Different components of the Canadian state begin to implement emergency measures with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic. April 2021. Quebec is the only North American jurisdiction that has imposed a curfew on its population. On April 11th, after having been previously relaxed by 90 minutes, the curfew is set to resume starting at 8 p.m. A call circulates on Instagram, Snapchat, and other platforms to show up in Montreal's Old Port to defy the curfew. Accounts associated with the graffiti subculture are the first to boost the call, but then Rebel News picks it up, a Canada-based right-wing agitprop outfit that has journalists on the ground, especially in Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods. What transpires is a street party featuring a few hundred people, fireworks, garbage can fires, loud music, and relatively safe outdoor masklessness. Most participants in the event are presumably residents of Montreal and the near environs. Despite rhetoric to the contrary from journalists who don't attend, the event is multiracial, probably majority people of color. Teenagers and young men are disproportionately represented among the participants. It's unclear when the more ostentatious acts of vandalism and arson begin, but towards 9 p.m., riot police move in to shut the party down, issue tickets, and make arrests, though in fact they make none. The next few days see a number of people, especially younger people, attempt to defy the curfew in collective as well as individual ways. One kid explains that she will continue to defy the curfew every day. September 2021. Trudeau wins another Canadian election. The balance of power in Parliament doesn't change at all, but there is an alarming development. The People's Party of Canada, or PPC, the vanity project of disaffected conservative politician Maxime Bernier, who had nearly become conservative leader in 2017, and since its founding the most credible electoral option for the anti-immigrant far-right in Canada, quadruples its share of the vote, though without winning any seats. The PPC, in effect, has become the most high-profile political force against lockdowns and vaccine mandates. Some people are buying what they're selling. December 2021. Just as many people believe that the pandemic is drawing to a close, the Omicron wave begins. The first inkling of an idea for a convoy to Ottawa emerges, apparently among some people with variously anti-vaccine, white nationalist, and Western separatist affiliations organized under the name Canada Unity. January 15th, 2022. A mandate comes into effect that obliges transportation workers who cross the border from the U.S. into Canada to be vaccinated. January 22nd. The convoy departs from Prince George in British Columbia, heading east to Ottawa. There are allegedly about 1,200 trucks and other vehicles by the time the convoy reaches Winnipeg on January 24th, but true numbers are hard to estimate. Solidarity convoys later depart from southern Ontario in Nova Scotia. There are reports that there may also be a convoy or two coming from the United States, but these do not pan out. January 28th. The first trucks arrive in Ottawa. From the very first evening, the protest is extremely loud. It will get louder. January 29th. More trucks arrive in Ottawa. Some of the participants harass people wearing masks and local service workers, and desecrate the monuments around downtown Ottawa. The border crossing at Coutts, Alberta, facing Sweetgrass, Montana, is the site of a blockade. It remains in place as we go to press. February 5th. A counter-demonstration in Vancouver is the largest mobilization against a convoy protest to date, certainly outside of Ottawa. It's not actually that big. People do their best to hold the convoy up in traffic. There are other convoy protests in various cities around the country. February 7th. A judge rules that the protesters cannot honk their horns for 10 days. Although things quiet down a bit, a lot of honking goes on nevertheless. Aligned protesters block the Ambassador Bridge between Detroit and Windsor. February 10th. Aligned protesters establish another blockade between Emerson, Manitoba, and Pembina, North Dakota. It remains in place as we go to press. February 12th. There are more rallies around the country, typically drawing hundreds of people, including one in Montreal and one in Halifax. Anarchists participate in counter-demonstrations, with smaller turnouts, at both of these. Another blockade is set up at the border crossing between Vancouver and Seattle. February 13th. After an operation lasting more than 24 hours, police clear the blockade of the Ambassador Bridge. As of now, we don't know all the details about what happened in Windsor. The police operation to remove the occupiers began on the morning of February 12th. They were not removed until very late on February 13th. The police report that up to 30 protesters were arrested. As we prepare to release this podcast, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has invoked the Emergencies Act, temporarily granting the federal government sweeping powers. Among other things, this enables banks to freeze personal and business accounts suspected of being used to further the blockades, and they can freeze them without obtaining a court order. It's easy to imagine how this precedent could pave the way for the U.S. government to freeze bail funds and other accounts serving protesters in the U.S. as well, including anti-fascists and anarchists. This drives home that we are in a three-way contest with both far-right nationalists and centrist state authorities, in which the enemy of our enemy is not our friend. Any power that we permit either of these adversaries to gain will ultimately be used against us as well. If we legitimize any repressive measures that the Canadian state takes against these protesters, it will only be easier for the authorities to take the same measures against us when we try to change society for the better. We made this same point about liberals who celebrated the repressive measures, ranging from facial recognition software to crowdsourced social media snitching, used against right-wing participants in the January 6th disorder at the U.S. Capitol. This is why grassroots resistance to fascism is so important. It is the only way to defend ourselves and our neighbors without contributing to the development of an invasive and unaccountable centralized power. Why has the situation in Ottawa gone on so long? None of the following theories are entirely satisfactory, but here are some of the possible explanations for why the police have permitted the occupation to continue. Theory 1. The police in Ottawa are racist instruments of colonial and white supremacist law. The police in Ottawa react differently to protest movements that are predominantly white, right-wing, and Canadian nationalist than they do to other protesters. Some of the police are in cahoots with politically ambitious fascists, inside and outside of government. Yes, this is true. But this is Anarchy 101. While it's an important context to remember, by itself it doesn't do much to explain the situation in Ottawa or anywhere else. Theory 2. The authorities fear an outbreak of chaotic violence and bloodshed. I've heard a lot of arguments about this theory in recent days. Since when has the state cared about people getting hurt? In the lead-up to the November 19th raid on Coyote Camp, there was a blitz in the media about how there were guns and U.S. citizens, foreign agents, in the camp. In that case, that was just the state's justification for escalating. Of course, the average convoy protester has more in common with the police than the average target of police violence. See Theory 1. It is possible that there might be serious weapons available to some of the protesters, whether they are stockpiled in the trucks themselves or elsewhere. It is clear that a lot of the participants have had police or military training. I'd be shocked if there weren't a few Americans involved. It's true that government spokespeople will always play up how extreme and dangerous an adversary is, whether their agenda is to justify caution or aggression. But that doesn't mean that there isn't some truth to it in this case. There have already been some acts of violence, including vehicle ramming and attempted arson. Being appropriately cynical here, I think it's fair to say that most politicians and other officials calculate that their careers will be in trouble if decisions they are responsible for provoke anything deadly or otherwise outrageous. Theory 3. The Trudeau government is incompetent. The state has lost its capacity to govern. There are chain of command issues. Sure, someone must have fucked up. That's always a safe bet. People hesitate, people pass the buck, people don't know what's coming at them or what they ought to do about it. As in Theory 1, though, this is always happening, so it doesn't explain everything. Some liberals have been speculating about how surprisingly easy it was for protesters to occupy areas on Parliament Hill. Perhaps they assumed that there was a high-tech security system for situations like this, ready to deploy at the touch of a button. The truth is, when these facilities were established, the threat model they were facing was the possibility that a few hundred men with rifles would wander over from the United States. Later, the threat was nuclear war. No one envisioned this sort of situation, specifically the hybrid mixture of tactics that has made it difficult for the authorities to decide how to respond. If you listen to a certain kind of conservative, you'll hear that the muscles of the state, specifically the military, have been allowed to atrophy, and that this problem goes back decades. In the face of external threats, Canada has always relied on the security umbrella of another power to protect its existence as an autonomous geopolitical entity. At first, that other power was Britain, but it has been the United States since the end of World War II. This is a problem, given that, historically and perhaps right now, the greatest threats to Canadian sovereignty haven't come from Russia or China, but from the United States, sometimes from the federal government in Washington, sometimes from non-state political actors. It was the Hunter's Lodge and the Fenian Brotherhood back then. Maybe it's Trumpists and QAnon today. The one obvious error on the part of the police and government was allowing the convoy to enter Ottawa at all. In February 2019, the last time a right-wing truck convoy rolled into town, it was all over in less than 48 hours, without much fuss. Perhaps that gave the authorities a false sense of security. Or perhaps we have to return to Theory 1, that cops are colluding with the fascists. Theory 4. Very powerful people like that this is happening. There is a conspiracy theory circulating to the effect that the governing liberals want the situation in Ottawa and the border blockades to continue, because some conservative politicians support the movement. The logic is that this will provide material that the liberals will be able to use to beat the conservatives for many elections to come. Another theory has it that this is happening at the behest of corporate interests, specifically those connected to the oil and gas industry. Vaccine skeptics are also climate skeptics, and there's been a lot of fear-mongering from the Ottawa occupiers about future climate lockdowns. If we are to believe self-styled gangster for capitalism Smedley Butler about the business plot, I would not put it past corporate interests to do whatever they can to secure conditions that will allow them to continue to maximize their profits forever. Under the present system, there's probably no longer any electoral path to a sitting Canadian parliament that would furnish the ideal conditions for petrocapitalism, i.e. no carbon tax, even more heavy-handed approaches to anti-development camps and activity, and the like. This could represent petrocapitalists experimenting with another approach. Ultimately, attempting to explain this situation is akin to the sociologists trying to explain the May 1968 uprising in France. By themselves, our theories won't change what is happening. The question is, what should we do about it? By the way, we probably shouldn't call these people truckers. The transportation industry has been under threat for a long time now. At some point, it is presumed, automation, that is, self-driving vehicles and delivery drones, will become the new means of delivering goods from place to place. This will significantly reduce the need for human workers who drive big rigs, if not eliminated entirely. The trucker might be a reasonable stand-in for a problem that faces large segments of the working class as a whole. In Canada, as many have noted, the vast majority of truckers are vaccinated already. About 1 in 5 people employed in the industry is South Asian, and there are more who are non-white and/or come from other countries. The convoy, the occupation, and the aligned blockades and rallies are not representative of truckers at all. Certainly there are some truckers involved, but Are we talking about hardworking people who got fired over their vaccination status? Or those who own trucking companies, capitalists with fleets of big rigs and spare time? Whatever the case, I think it's pretty clear that most of the participants in this event have historically made a living in some way other than trucking. This is especially true of the crowd that has been gathering on Saturdays and Sundays. Among the hardcore Ottawa occupiers, there are all sorts there by now. Some of these people are rainbow gathering types, or young, perpetually high locals who are on their way to becoming rainbow gathering types, if only circumstance would grant them the opportunity. Some of them are probably people whose previous housing options were not very desirable, who have the right attributes to fit in among the convoy folks. They may not be political at all, just happy to help out in the ways they can, among people who haven't yet given them the cold shoulder. It seems obvious to me, however, that the most commonly shared characteristics of most of the resident occupiers is that they were involved in right-wing street activism of some kind before 2022. At the very least, their politics are generally aligned with some of the right-wing populist movements in Canada, be that La Meute, Maxime Bernier's PPC, or the Canadian Yellow Vests. Last week, the anarchist radio show and podcast From Embers interviewed a union-involved anarchist employed in the transportation industry, who spoke with some insight on the labor side of this issue, such as it is, and how much buy-in there really is from truckers as a class. Among other things, the interviewee mentioned the Naujawan Support Network, an initiative born in part of local efforts to support the farmers' protests in India, but focused on local issues, including wage theft by the employers of truckers in Peel region, a major center of logistics in the Greater Toronto area and Canada as a whole. Make no mistake, I don't think the exploited workers that the state media is only now talking about are the real truckers any more than the ones in Ottawa are. Anyone who's done much hitchhiking on this continent knows that a lot of truckers spend a lot of time by themselves listening to radio programs, or these days, podcasts and live streams, that amplify some pretty wild ideas. The Biden administration has also imposed a vaccine mandate on truckers entering the United States. Keeping in mind that some truckers are business owners, not workers, I expect things could look pretty different if the planned U.S. convoy effort succeeds. Beyond Ottawa, the movement in the streets. Although there have been many other demonstrations in Montreal against curfews, lockdowns, vaccine passports, and the like, February 12th was the first convoy-related demonstration in the city. It was immediately obvious that most of the people who attended were normal people. That is alarming, because judging from the signs they were carrying, normal people are capable of believing things that I consider absurd or unconscionable. But, of course, I am not a normal person. In A Wager on the Future, Joseph Gardeneyes writes, "It makes perfect sense to speak of normal people in reference to a category from which we are excluded. The normal person is the normalized person, the one who follows society's norms. Being an anarchist is not normal." Gardeneyes referred to society as if it is always a single thing. But today, parallel societies are emerging along the fault lines determined, at least in part, by living in rival information silos. In this situation, we can speak of the norms that the normal, normalized people inherited from the previous society, as well as the new norms that are coming into being. One thing that was normal, that was widely accepted, in theory if not always in practice, was the idea that in a democratic society, when you are mad about a government policy, you march around peacefully with flags and signs. You chant and sing, you become something that they cannot ignore, to paraphrase an old slogan from 2012, but you stop there. Although Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and others like them faced opposition every step of the way, there is now a consensus that they were good people, and the simplistic, whitewashed memory of figures like those provides a template for what one ought to do in a situation like this, when everyone is angry about the general state of things. Considering that at least one poll suggests that a third of Canadians surveyed felt that they had a lot in common with the goals of the convoy when it initially rolled into Ottawa, it is imperative to understand that many of the people showing up to these actions do not have fixed political identities yet. They are less politically literate, less politically entrenched than we are, and therefore less likely to recognize the telltale signs of overtly racist, chauvinist, and otherwise objectionable politics in their fellow marchers, but also less likely to understand our arguments or be moved by them. we need to identify what opportunities these events might open up, rather than simply seeking yet another confirmation that we are all doomed, or that everyone else in our society has lost their minds. The political terrain is shifting. I do not think the left is going to be able to stop that shift simply by showing up and opposing the right-wing people who see themselves as opposing the current order. Some of the people who are calling for that approach are my friends, and I share their concerns, but I think that is a recipe for failure. We have to think bigger. When we only react, we tire ourselves out without ever setting the agenda. Worse, we enable the far right to portray us as tools advocating for the liberal ruling order who lack any genuinely transformative program of our own. We need to look for new possibilities in this situation. In April to May 2020, when the far right were holding armed protests at government buildings in the U.S., anarchists didn't go and defend the city halls. Anarchists and many other people who hate the police took action on a different front, responding to the murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other black people, and thereby changed the whole terrain of discourse. In fact, because of their brief friction with the police who were defending those government buildings, the far right took weeks to react to the uprising of May 2020, during which the uprising gained a tremendous amount of ground and temporarily eclipsed their entire agenda in the public eye. In short, anarchists were not reactive, but proactive, and it paid off. In the face of massive historical developments, the inclination to react to everything that our adversaries do and the inclination to keep doing what we were doing before are both blind alleys. When things change, it's a good chance to reevaluate what we were doing, look for new opportunities, and hazard new experiments in light of the new conditions. Here are some notes towards that purpose. Obstacles and hazards. Number one, this is a reactionary movement. In 2015, Friends in Ontario's Common Cause anarchist organization, since defunct, wrote that reactionary ideas, broadly defined, are political beliefs that develop in response to social change and which seek a reversal of said change, usually in the form of a return to some idealized past. Using this definition, I think it's pretty clear that these ideas are what motivate the mass mobilization of the convoy to Ottawa and things happening elsewhere. The pandemic has meant profound social change, and a lot of people have been afraid and angry about that change the entire time. At this point, now that the promise that we could simply vaccinate ourselves back to normal has failed, many relatively progressive or at least sober-minded people want a return to some idealized past. It's not just folks who thought this was all a Chinese plot from day one. Common Cause argued that reactionary tendencies are reactionary ideas, public forums, small organized groups, and other elements that have not yet coalesced into a full-scale reactionary movement. In 2022, though, it's clear that this is indeed a movement. Some people in the movement are particularly noxious. Consequently, some anarchists and other radicals are doubling down on arguments that we should oppose and attack everyone involved uniformly. There have been lots of arguments about this recently, mostly to the effect of, I don't care if you're a person of color, lost your job, lost your small business, just a houseless person looking to get a meal, etc. If you're marching next to Nazis and you're not punching Nazis, then you're a Nazi, and you should be punched too. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but this is the real position expressed by some folks in my city's radical scenes. Someone said, so who's the Canadian David Rovics? With respect to this report back from a walk-around in Ottawa, even when the article, in a subsequent comment, strongly opposes the notion that there is anything good to be found in movements organized by fascists. For my part, I have no idea what an anarchist could possibly get out of participating in the occupation in Ottawa as a good faith actor. I was scandalized to hear that someone, in a scene quite different from mine, might have gone to Ottawa with an anarcho-feminist sign and chilled with the protesters. From my perspective, this person was merely providing a thoroughly reactionary movement with some rhetorical cover. Look, we are the people. We even have some nice anarchists involved. Obstacles and hazards 2. This movement is spearheaded and promoted by fascists, authoritarians, and other enemies of everyone else who genuinely values freedom and solidarity. I know that people like to argue about what terms like these mean. So do I. But at least one of these designations is applicable in the cases of Pat King, who was involved from very early on and who is concerned about whites being replaced and hates immigrants and gay people. Jason LaFosse, background in the fascist group Soldiers of Odin, organizer for the Ontario contingent of the convoy. Rambo Gaultier, background in La Meute, organizer of the less successful convoy to downtown Quebec City. And Donald Trump, who signaled his politically important support for the movement even before many Canadians had heard of it, included in a coup attempt last year. Just because these sorts of people set things off, that doesn't mean that they control the movement, let alone own it. They're probably destined to fight each other over the remains of the movement at some point in the future. There's currently a campaign to disassociate a few people who, it seems, lit some things on fire in the lobby of an apartment building where some residents had apparently fought with convoy-associated protesters earlier. Although the claim that the seeming arsonists had nothing to do with the right-wing protests seems unlikely, it also seems likely that this initiative had nothing to do with any strategically minded higher-ups. Groups of people who already knew each other, or who have gotten to know each other by now on the ground in Ottawa, have their own agendas, their own ways of doing things. And at some point, a lot of them are going to suspect that some of the high-profile leaders that they thought were on their side are willing to sell them out. Obstacles and hazards 3. This is creating a liberal backlash. The events in Ottawa and at various points along the U.S.-Canada border are setting the stage for a liberal, pro-police, pro-civility backlash that will hit us as well. At some point, the occupation will come to an end. That may come after bloodshed, or after the loss of access to funds, or targeted arrests, or the actions of people in Ottawa themselves who are sick and tired of the Flu Trucks Klan encamping in their city. But after that happens, it may be more difficult for us to act as well. I used to know some punks who lived in Centertown in Ottawa, back when it was still relatively affordable. If things had gone differently in my life, I might have moved there too. Even assuming my street was relatively quiet, I imagine I would be a little antagonistic in response to sustained honking and people chanting, "Freedom!" whenever I had to go downtown. I suspect, too, that if I were by myself, I probably wouldn't feel very safe pushing back. This feeling of impotence would make me feel even angrier. I'm an anarchist, so I would deal with these things the way that an anarchist does, but other people might not. Underslept because the honkening has kept them up, others might go onto Twitter and coin a new word like honkening. They might say, "I want to see the same sort of force that is applied against the Wet'suwet'en protesters applied against these protesters." They might begin talking to their friends, neighbors, and allies, i.e. party Maoists shipped in on short notice or Trotskyists from the local universities, seeking more direct solutions to the problem. As a resident of noisy downtown Montreal, I'm sympathetic to an anti-noise position. I hate Ottawa as much as anyone else does, I guess, which is to say, a lot. But the nation's capital is not just bureaucrats, politicians, and other people with cushy gigs, even if that's the stereotype. Ottawa has always had a working class, and it still does. In view of the politics of the occupiers, my sympathies are with the people affected by the occupation. From the reports I've heard, it appears that some anarchists are participating in the counter-protests opposing the occupation. But if they are trying to assert anarchist ideas and priorities in doing so, that has not been apparent from afar. The dominant current in the counter-protests is settler not-in-my-backyardist, not anti-colonial revolutionary. It's hard to imagine how that could change. It seems to me that it might be more productive to distinguish ourselves from the NIMBYists, too, because their movement is also reactionary, according to the Common Cause definition. They, too, want to go back to the way things were before. Things like this, in the histrionic terms that some people are using, the insurrection, the siege of Ottawa, aren't supposed to happen here. Make them all go away. If the police won't enforce peace and quiet, the citizens must take over the job of the police. The role of the anarchist in this case is not to show up to protests with better signs than the cop lovers. It's to create a third side that is neither pro-police nor pro-occupation, a side rooted in the concerns of locals who are variously pro-revolutionary against the Canadian state, anti-colonial for Indigenous sovereignty, and against the police. One thing that this third side could do would be to organize mutual aid initiatives. A lot of spontaneous initiatives have already cropped up in downtown Ottawa during these last weeks in response to real and perceived needs. Anarchists should be there, building a counter-civility that is polite but has no patience for statist bullshit. The goal would be to make sure that locals who are mad right now have mixed loyalties later on, which would be much better than rock-solid loyalties to the Liberal Party or the local police chief. If the counter-demonstrators do gain momentum, we must emphasize that police are not a solution to the problem of outsiders disrupting our communities. They are another manifestation of it. If the occupation has gone on so long because of the complicity of the police, this is not an aberration from what the police are supposed to do. It's consistent with the way police always behave. In the United States, police officers participated in the storming of the Capitol on January 6th, too. But afterwards, the Democrats were still able to use the whole debacle to rehabilitate their image. We should not leave them any space to do the same here. What's more, if the police are indeed part of the problem, then those who are decrying the so-called insurrection today will have to learn what is valuable about disruptive tactics themselves. When this little chapter of Canadian history reaches its conclusion, we don't want the police or the Liberals to be able to use the events in Ottawa to justify exerting more pressure on us when we engage in protest activity ourselves. It's certain that any legitimacy they acquire through these events, they will employ against us. Obstacles and hazards number 4. This looks like it might be another step towards civil war in the United States. If this is a step towards civil war, personally, I'm not looking forward to it. I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow, but civil war, or worse, an unopposed authoritarian coup, has become thinkable. Most of the crises that have affected the United States in the past few years, from the subprime mortgage crisis to riot waves, have hit Canada only glancingly. A civil war would hit existentially hard. The Ottawa occupation has provided a new template for political action that apparently works. We've heard tale of a copycat action planned in Washington, D.C. on March 4th. I'll be paying attention to see what happens. My feeling is that we need to be prepared for the worst outcomes. Sometimes, the paradigm changes really fast. Opportunities. Number 1. Other people can occupy too, and create zones where people can meet their needs without money. To some degree, in some places, this has already been happening. In Montreal, the Terrain Vague, more or less translated as the wasteland, in the city's east end is an example of this. Anarchists and numerous others, neighborhood leftists who are not anarchists, people without steady or reliable access to good shelter, ravers, taggers, dog walkers, have been using the space for years. But starting at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a new investment of energy, among the people I know at least, towards resisting the area's long-planned redevelopment. Efforts to redevelop the area include expanding the capacity of the nearby port, rationalizing the road layout, improving highway access to the area, with some promises of family-friendly and aesthetically pleasing bits of parkland in the future. There are many aspects to this struggle, and the ways that people have been using the space more recently, but it provided a space that was lacking in the context of worries about COVID-19. It was a place to socialize, where the norm was probably a little COVID unsafe, but where people with less cavalier attitudes could still hang out, and maybe even drink a beer. I don't want to offend anyone, but the Terrain Vague kind of sucks. There's no free food. It's also far away from everything. It's possible to get lost or trip over things. The weather impacts the pleasantness of the place in a big way. In all of this, the situation is very different from what we've seen in Ottawa, where money is poured in that has facilitated a significant degree of infrastructural development. There are buildings around, there are truck cabs, they apparently even have saunas there now. Many other people have been creating spaces elsewhere around Montreal. There have been secret Black Lives Matter dance parties on the mountain. There have been swells of people cheering for the local hockey team, shooting fireworks in the streets, turning over police cars, and so on. Most of this has lacked a counter-logistical purpose or even political intent of any kind. And while there is a certain sort of anarchist who may like it for just those reasons, fucking shit up for its own sake has its charm, I think that limits the scope of how far these things can go. Sure, it would be nice if the police would clear out for long enough that we could see how things might develop without them. What if the people who showed up in the old port on April 11th of last year had been able to hold ground in one of the fanciest neighborhoods of the city, a place chiefly reserved for tourists? Where could that have gone after 3 weeks? This is just what could have been, of course. we know the reason that April 11th didn't continue. The police would never tolerate an occupation of that character in that place. But in the current moment, when policing logistics are being stretched thin across the Canadian territory, in some regions more than others, sure, it might be possible to choose a site and hold ground. By doing so, we could contribute in a small way to the breakdown of the logistics of the police, which is arguably a good thing. To liberals who argue that we need the police to protect us from the sort of people who have congregated in Ottawa, we can answer that the police have done very little to protect ordinary workers in Ottawa, even without us disrupting their logistics at all. Based on what we're seeing in Ottawa, the best way to ensure collective safety will be to develop our own networks, spaces, and collective experience, rather than depending on the police, who mostly focus on evicting people and keeping poor people hungry in any case. Speaking of which, this past summer, downtown public parks in Halifax, Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, and other cities hosted encampments of people who don't have enough money to live in a house or an apartment. Across the board, city governments, including those of ostensibly progressive administrations, like the government here in Montreal, cleared these encampments, giving people, our fellow Canadians, if you like, the option of living in highly surveilled and invasively managed shelters, often far from resources they rely upon that had been much more accessible from those parks. If it is a nuisance for people to occupy public parks in this way, then why not seize buildings instead? For those involved in the spirited but unsuccessful efforts to defend encampments at Lamport Stadium in Toronto, or in front of the old Halifax Library last summer, now might be the time to launch something just as ambitious. Perhaps it will be possible to make the last leg of Canadian winter more tolerable for people who are currently sleeping on the streets. Opportunity number two. This could be a good time to mobilize against the border itself. If there's a contradiction inside the protests centered in Ottawa, it's that right-wing people love borders, police, and state power, but this is ostensibly a protest against the border, the police, and the power of the state under its current management. This could be a fault line along which we might force a rupture between the people who are there out of an ignorant desire to rebel and those who are there out of a cynical desire to advance a fascist statist project. The fact that the right-wing anti-mandate protesters consider vaccine passports fascism, but also want to establish more border controls to make it harder to get any kind of passport, should represent a vulnerability for them. In France, anarchists used the tactic of property destruction to carve out a space in the Yellow Vest movement. Much of the far right did not want to be associated with property destruction, whereas many of the random angry people who got involved in the movement were comfortable with it. Perhaps actually opposing the border itself could have a similar impact here. At a minimum, it would force the far-right participants who pretend to want freedom to show that they actually support borders, police, state control, and being oppressed. This is personal for me. I hate the U.S.-Canada border. All anarchists who have to deal with it hate it. Although dual citizens have it easier than most, even they can be interrogated for hours every time they cross. Anarchists with only one of the relevant passports find it very difficult to cross at an official point of entry if they have a certain kind of detectable criminal record. I came of age after September 11th, 2001. The U.S.-Canadian border has always been a challenge. Nothing like the mostly seamless intra-Schengen borders I've experienced in Europe. It used to be that you could cross it without a passport. A driver's license from one country or the other was enough. Certainly lots of people were denied entry in the 1990s and earlier, but the border was long and not particularly well defended. After the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, things got a lot harder, mainly thanks to new policies on the U.S. side. As of June 1, 2009, Canadian citizens need passports to enter the U.S., with another option for a somewhat cheaper special identity card called the Nexus card. Today, there are more cameras and remote sensors all along the border than there used to be, and the consequences for getting caught are severe. But if it were easier to go from one country to another, I would probably go more often, and my life might be richer for it. The occupation in Ottawa and the bigger movement has always been broadly opposed to all mandates and measures aimed at mitigating the pandemic, whatever they are. What's novel about the current mobilization, in comparison to the enormous anti-lockdown demonstrations that have taken place in Montreal, Toronto, and other cities, is that it has been about freedom of movement across the border from the very beginning. The justification for all of this was the vaccine mandate imposed on truckers crossing into Canada from the United States. Unvaccinated workers who regularly worked border crossing routes lost their jobs. The convoy's arrival in Ottawa coincided with the establishment of a blockade at the Canadian side of the border between Coutts, Alberta, and Sweetgrass, Montana. This was followed by a blockade of another prairie border crossing in Manitoba, and then the Ambassador Bridge from Windsor, Ontario to Detroit, which is the largest single trade corridor by volume on the entire border. There's talk of another potential blockade at the Fort Erie Buffalo Crossing, perhaps with U.S. allies on the American side. A new blockade has just appeared at Douglas, British Columbia. The blockade at Coutts, Alberta, not at the border post but just north of town, initially prevented all traffic from moving north or south. The situation has changed a few times, but as we publish, the blockade has softened, i.e. there's one narrow lane of traffic open for emergency vehicles, police, and local Coutts residents. But it remains solidly in place. For the first few days, when the blockade was at full force, Coutts was effectively cut off from the rest of Canada. If things continue to develop in this direction, we may well see open defiance of the border itself, that is, irregular border crossing. It seems to me that if we are to intervene in the convoy movement at all, the better opportunities are not in Ottawa, but along the border, with the intent of pushing for its effective negation. Considering that we find those who are leading the other border disruptions despicable, it might behoove us to organize our own blockades, with our own messaging, perhaps with our own allies on the other side. Perhaps, in the general confusion, our efforts could blossom into spaces that are worth coming to on their own merits, like many other counter-logistical occupation sites. Maybe this will contribute to the larger general chaos. I'd like to think that we can make common cause with some of the people who live in border communities who hate the border too. There has never really been a good opening for anti-border organizing in Canada before. We might not be able to persuade everyone that a borderless world would be a better one, but we could at least force more people to question whether the U.S.-Canada border actually benefits or protects them. This is an issue that could split both the conservative and liberal camps, disrupting the false dichotomy they have established. For now, this is all talk, and it would be a major challenge. But it could be a significant missed opportunity to sit out the first popular protest against the border without posing the questions we want to ask. For more information and updates, you can visit crimethink.com. For more audiobooks, audio zines, and podcasts from The X Worker, visit crimethink.com/podcasts.